strangers. Welcome to the Upside Down Podcast. Today, I'm going to be talking to Tristan Spohn, who plays number two on Stranger Things Season 4. He is so nice. He is nothing like his character on the show. He's not evil at all. We had a great chat, and I hope you enjoyed this. Just keep in mind that we talked via Skype, and also we discuss heavily him attending San Diego Comic-Con, which is long past, but the conversation was so funny that I just left it in. I think that you will enjoy it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Enjoy this first interview of our fourth season. Stay strange.
Hello, this is Tristan Spohn. I play two in Stranger Things 4, and you're listening to the Upside Down Podcast.
Hey, Tristan.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, this is Ash from the Upside Down Podcast. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love doing these kinds of things. So.
Also, congratulations. It must be pretty rad to be a part of a show that just got 13 nominations, including Best Outstanding Drama.
Oh, yeah, that's super cool, especially because this was the first project I ever booked. So for the first thing to ever do to get 13 Emmy noms, I mean, that's just a blessing for sure.
I was reading a little bit about your bio, and I really love your biography because you like endearingly give these shout outs to like your mom and your dad, and you talk about like where they work, and I'm like, this is the most sweet bio ever. You're like telling your whole story about growing up in Texas, and I'm like, this is so sweet. How excited were they for you when you got cast in this role?
Oh gosh, I don't even know how to explain it. I mean, it's one of those things where obviously any creative probably knows that in the beginning they get a little bit of that friction because their parents want them to have the best possible life and be safe and secure financially. And so anytime someone goes after something that is unpredictable and unguaranteed, it's a little bit scary, but it's been really cool because both my mom and my dad are my biggest cheerleaders, and it's been a wild experience to finally start making money from something that I've just always loved to do for fun. So they're super stoked. They were the first people I called right after I found out I booked it. So,
well, I saw that you went to Booker T. Washington High School, which if anybody doesn't know is a really kind of acclaimed performing arts school. So your family kind of, they had to have some kind of inkling deep inside that you weren't going to be like a lawyer. They had to know what was happening.
It's honestly, it's interesting because for the longest time growing up, I thought I was going to be in the NFL. I actually didn't go to Booker T. Washington until my junior year of high school. So for the first 2 years, I was going the football route. I would make like little YouTube videos. I took theater class, but other than that, I was very, very much so committed to the football, to where I would just be by myself in the front yard throwing the ball to myself, just fun, and working on my tackle breaking skills again. Then I went to Booker T. I quit football because I realized I didn't love it anymore. And then there is the question of, well, crap, this is what I've wanted to do my entire life. How do I possibly move forward from giving up what used to be my dream? And so Booker T very much so came from my mom being friends with one of the head of public relations for the school. My mom knew I did some YouTube videos, so she thought it could be cool for me to try out for something that explored a little bit of that, and then it just kind of went from there.
Was there an instance where you just decided football wasn't for you anymore? Was it because you were going at it so hard it was just too much, or what? I'm just curious, if it was your dream for so long, what was it that was like the breaking point that made you go like, no athletics, yes drama?
Honestly, it was a very weirdly gradual and instantaneous at the same time. I always wanted to be a wide receiver, but I was never put in that position. I would either be linebacker or safety. I always was on defense, even though I was terrible at tackling and I was super slow. And so really my dream position would have been like tight end, but I was never properly utilized. But I was like, one day if I keep my nose at it, it'll be fine. Then around when the Ebola crisis, be a couple of cases that popped up in Texas, my mom was just like, I want you to just sit one practice out just to be safe. We don't really know what's going on. So because Ebola can be spread through sweat and blood, let's be safe. And so I sat that one practice out. And the euphoria I of not having to go to practice made me realize, oh, I have slowly started to allow my relationship to this thing I always dreamed about to deteriorate. And to, I'd been attaching so much of my identity to this one specific aspect of my life that was no longer actually servicing me anymore. And it wasn't until I had that moment where I removed myself from it instead of just having my head down grinding and working it out that I realized I'm working towards something that isn't actually making me happy anymore. So it was instantaneous, because as soon as I set that practice out, I finally had that realization, but it was a gradual loss of my love for the game.
So once you got into acting, did you kind of take on the same mentality where you were like, you know, you went so hard at football and then you decided it wasn't for you, and then when you decided you wanted to act, all right, it's time to put my head down and stick in the grind and go for it?
Yes and no. I've had so many phases with that. It definitely started as just something I love to do. I would make all of these YouTube videos that weren't for the sake of acting. I just happened to be acting when I was making them. I've actually more so been in love with writing. In fact, when I was in high school, I actually opened like my own freelance writing business off of Fiverr, and I was making a little bit of a steady, at least for like a high schooler, I was making a little bit of income from writing, actually. And so more than anything, I only acted because I was too scared to ask other people to be in the stuff I wrote. And then it just kind of went from there. Then I went to Los Angeles and I got so caught up in like, oh, I'm in Los Angeles and this is cool, to the point where I stopped really doing anything to work on my craft. I just kind of was in that situation where I was like, well, I'm in Los Angeles, so it's just going to happen now. And I got very reactive instead of proactive. And so it wasn't until I failed out there and had to come back to Texas that I started to really dig deep into what I actually wanted my life to be, why I even wanted to be an actor. And as soon as I finally started to dig into the why, I started to see, oh, this is the part of acting that I love, so let me put my head down and start really working towards that aspect of it to see what happens. So I started that way, I lost it, and then I went back to it.
When you auditioned for the role of Two for Stranger Things, had you initially auditioned for Stranger Things before? Now, I know you're in Texas, but that's, you know, relatively close to Atlanta in terms of travel. I imagine you auditioned for a lot of things that take place locally in the city.
Yeah, so I want to start by saying that I am just so blessed and honored to have Lee Keen, who's my wonderful, beautiful, lovely agent, who has been one of my biggest cheerleaders ever. And she's been such a huge reason for why all of these opportunities have come my way, because it's allowed me the chance to still build these relationships with casting directors in Atlanta and Los Angeles while still being located in Texas. And so it's not as much that, because it's more so just because I have Lee, who's able to give me those bridging connections. I have read for the show multiple times, though, or not multiple times. I read for it once. I read for Eddie Munson, I want to say like a year, because then they, of course, shut everything down. But I read for Eddie Munson like a year before I ended up booking Two. But before that, I read with Carmen Cuba probably like 5 or 6 times, like with different other projects and roles. And so when it came to being cast as Two, Carmen actually requested me through my agent to read for it. So it wasn't like my agent submitted me and then they were like, oh, we like his look, let's bring him in. They physically, because of all the other tapes I had done and because they knew my skill set, they reached out and were like, yo, Tristan seems like he'd be a cool match for this. Let's see what he can do. So
that's awesome to hear. One thing I think is funny is when I talk to actors who, you know, any fan would see as like a megastar. Like, you've been on Stranger Things now and you've starred with Millie and Matthew and Jamie, but you're still humble and in Texas and working at your wedding venue. Right now as I interview, I see this beautiful venue behind you. Do you have any fans? Like, you're very vocal about like, hey, I'm in Texas and I work at this place. Do you have fans coming by?
It's interesting. So the funny part about it all is that I would honestly say that the majority of my fan base is actually in Brazil. You United States people actually follow me. I haven't had like specifically fans coming to the venue to, like, be like, oh my god, is Two working here or anything like that, but I do get recognized at the venue pretty frequently because I think it's one of those things where people don't specifically come to see me, but because I'm so vocal about it, a lot of people, they'll see me, they'll be like, you look really similar to this actor that I know, and then they go and look me, because there's always that funny, like, dance where I can feel that someone's looking at me and that they think they might know me from somewhere, but they don't distinctly know. And then they go on their phone, 5 seconds goes by, and then they kind of approach after that. But no, not yet. I think that's the cool thing, is most people wouldn't expect it in Texas, and so it's allowed me to not really have this big, like, privacy invasion or anything like that, which is good.
I think the difference is, too, is that when you're in character as Two, you come across as very hard, you're hardened, you have some issues, and, you know, you look different, your head is shaved, and when you post pictures of yourself, or you talk about yourself, or you talk about journaling as your character, Two, you come across as very gentle and sweet, and so I think when people see you, they wouldn't automatically connect with, oh, that's that bully. I don't think they would connect that with you at all.
Which is the biggest blessing. Like, one of my favorite responses to the show have been when my friends and family have told me, I could not even tell that was you. Like, it was so different from who you are that I forgot I was watching Tristan. As an actor, the biggest honor in the world, I think.
You were really, really great in that role. I'm sure you've heard that like 100 times, but it was so interesting. I always am looking out for people that are new on the show because we always just want to talk to anybody in the Stranger Things community, and I wasn't sure that I had even found you. There was like a picture of you with your long, beautiful, flowing hair, and I was like, I don't think this is him. This guy looks too nice. And then I scrolled down a little, and you originally didn't post that much about Stranger Things. You had, because you know they don't let you, you had like one image, I think, when the show came out, and I found it halfway in your feed, and I was like, okay, Tristan, this is you. So let's talk about Stranger Things. I think what I'm going to do is, normally I have a set of questions that I want to ask you, but you have a very big fan base. Maybe it's Brazil, maybe it's the U.S., who knows? But they've asked...
It's probably Brazil.
But they've given us a lot of questions to ask you, so I think this will answer a lot of things that people want to know. So Sani wants to know, when you originally shaved your head and you got the buzz cut, was anyone suspicious of you? Were they like, did you recently get a role? Did you shave your head for Stranger Things? Because I know a lot of actors in town were walking around with shaved heads, and people were like, maybe.
I mean, yes and no. I distinguish that because in terms of, like, friends and family, they know I'm an actor. I'm so heavily defined by my hair because, like you said, everyone says I have this long, flowy, beautiful hair, and so that's what I get complimented on the most. So all my friends and family, they saw me, they're immediately like, oh, you did something, didn't you? Because they know I wouldn't join the military, so they're like, you've either booked something or you're going through an identity crisis. Are you okay? But in terms of, like, just walking about, not really.
Interesting. Sadie Mae wants to know, were you anxious about anything like filming for the first time on such a big show or making new friends?
Yes and no. I feel like I'm going to say yes and no to every question because everything has this gray area. But the really beautiful thing about Stranger Things specifically, and it's been cool going on other sets and seeing all the vibes and atmospheres are different, but of course there's that anxiety of this being the first thing I ever booked. We had to do a 5-day sequester in our hotel room and then get COVID tested, and of course I was so afraid I would get COVID and they would have to recast me and I would lose this opportunity. But everybody on that set is so welcoming and nurturing, to where it's intimidating at first, but with the way everybody welcomes everybody in with open arms, I very quickly just felt at ease and like I was just part of this big family creating something they loved. So
you're talking about how this is one of the first things that you've been cast in, and it's like one of the biggest shows ever, and you're, of course, as everyone wants to talk to you about, you're working with Millie, you're working with Matthew, you're working with Jamie, but it must have been really thrilling and kind of self-fulfilling, like self-actualizing, like, I shouldn't be a football player, I should be an actor, I'm here. How did your body, like, how did you take that in? How was it? Whoever directed you? Who directed you, the Duffers or Sean Levy?
The Duffers directed me, and my favorite director I've worked with in my entire life, Nimrod. He directed the first two episodes. Honestly, I heavily credit Nimrod as well for taking so much of the pressure off of me. I've never worked with someone more loving and supportive of his actors than Nimrod is. So,
yeah, that's amazing. So then when you were working with those big cast members, how were you able to internalize that? Like, what was it like for you the minute they walked on set?
I think if I'm honest, some of what I'm about to say comes from just being a little bit older, and I guess because I've had a lot of time to like really work on the craft. For me, it wasn't really as huge of a deal as I think some people would think it would be, only because I was able to get in this really cool like work zone headspace when I was on set, to where I intentionally was like, I'm not even going to think about that. I need to just shut that part of my brain off, be as just present and like here as I can, not think about that. Because as soon as I start thinking about that, I'm going to feel like I need to impress and put on a show and basically go against the grain of what this character is. And I think I did a really good job of doing the whole 5-day sequester, having a bunch of time in between when I got to Atlanta and when I actually got on set. I was able to kind of get those nerves out and focus on the work I was there to do. With Millie, it was one of those things where she's my sister's biggest role model, and so being able to work with my sister's biggest role model was such a huge honor and blessing. And there were moments when I got to really acknowledge how blessed I am to be in that situation, and there was never a point when I didn't feel very lucky and blessed, but I had an ability to just shut that off so that I didn't even think about that. And it helps, too, that the way I got into character was completely disassociating. And so it would be this thing where I didn't even feel this control over my body. And so I felt like an observer more than I felt like I was physically in the room with like these big stars. I was just like, I don't know. I was so detached from myself as it was. It was hard to really think about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like when you're going to a party and you're super nervous and you show up and the person opens the door and you walk in the room and you're like, oh yeah, I'm here. Like it's like you build it up all in your brain, but the minute that you're there, you're like, I'm a part of this now. Like it's not as big as I thought it was going to be, or it is, but you're able to like cope with it a little bit better.
Being able to meet them and have them be so normal and so like not, like we put these things on a pedestal, and when you get there, when you meet them, and you see that they're humans just like the rest of us, all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm just working with other people that love the craft that I do, and they've just gotten a little bit more success, but fundamentally we have the same wants, desires, they have flaws just like the rest of us, and it immediately kind of takes that pedestal off and gets onto that even playing field in a way.
I think that's a good thing for fans to hear, especially younger kids who listen to the podcast and who like Stranger Things. It's good to know and respect Millie and all the kids, but they're also people, and they're just doing a job, and they're probably just glad that you like what they're doing. I thought this was a really good question. Nadine says, what do you think Two's backstory was going into the lab? She's been really curious about it since you would have been the second person to enter the lab after Brenner had already had, you know, what we now know to be some issues with One's character. What do you think it was like for Two? We didn't really get that.
I wasn't given anything, but I did, of course, develop my own kind of through line where in my personal backstory, I was super, super young when I entered the lab, and so because of that, the lab is all I've ever known. Brenner is basically my father, and all I've ever wanted is his love. And in my backstory, I briefly saw One in passing, but I haven't, it was so long ago that I didn't like fully remember who One actually was. I had this idea that we got in this fight one time, we were super small, and then he disappeared for a while, and then eventually when he came back, it had been so far in between that I didn't even recognize. But essentially just, my whole thing is that Papa's been telling us that he's training us to fight the bad man, which probably in the context of the story are the quote-unquote Russians. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's at least what I told myself, so that I had like a goal, because it's easy for like a character like that to feel like you don't have anything you're working towards, but that made me be able to feel like I've been destroying all of these little kids in every single experiment we've done. I'm waiting for Papa to finally see that I'm ready and that I am worthy of joining him outside to fight the bad men, and I am grappling with just the frustration that essentially, I've been dominating for a long time. I feel like I'm ready, and I'm waiting for Papa to agree.
I think this is a good question. I'm sure this is not this person's real name, but Buffalo Bill wanted to know, why do you think 2 was so cruel towards 11?
Purely because he's done. He's done with the lab. He thinks he's above the lab, as evidenced by how he dominates everything. And now in comes this kid. All 2's ever wanted is Papa to love him, and he's always fighting for the attention with all these other numbers. And then this girl comes in, kicks his butt, completely demoralizes him. And in 2's opinion, he thinks this is going to prevent Papa from ever thinking he's ever going to be ready to leave the lab. And so 2, it's not specifically that he doesn't like 11 as much as he's worried that she's now prevented him from ever leaving and thus ever having Papa's true love. So it's just him lashing out at that lack of validation.
He just sees that Brenner has a new favorite, and it's a little bit upsetting, or a lot upsetting, especially since she's consistently, at this point, not really living up to what she should be living up to, per se. And, you know, your character, you're like, I'm doing it. I'm doing the things that you want her to do. She can't do it. She cannot do it. And then she eventually does it, but that makes sense. Somebody had a really cute question. I'm not sure how he says his name. Tariq Zayad says, if 2 had survived and somehow escaped the lab with L that night in 1983, which of the other characters do you think he would have gotten along with in Hawkins? And do you think he might have been a little bit, he might have been changed kind of the way she was by a new community of love and friendship?
First off, love you, Tariq. He is one of my most, like, loyal, supportive followers. I see him comment all of these really cool, insightful comments on all my posts. But I actually, when we first had this post, I saw this comment, and I'm really trying to think about it, because I'm like, how would I answer this question? Because there's so many layers to it. I feel like the person he would have most connected with would be Billy, simply because I think they would be able to connect on both having a very tortured path with a problematic, like, adult figure in his life. And I think both characters have that vulnerability when you dig deep enough. And I think that what would inevitably happen is 2 would probably get along with Billy, and then he'd become one of the flayed, and then he would still end up dying by whatever and any of that. But I feel like Billy probably would have been the most, which makes sense too, because they had me read for the show with one of Billy's scenes from season 2. So I think they were looking for elements of him as well.
Crying Vecna says, if 2 was more powerful than L, like she didn't even exist, what do you think 2 would use his powers for? So in this scenario, 11 doesn't exist, so other than 1, which we don't know about, you're the most powerful number. Do you think you would end up achieving your goal of getting Papa's love, or do you think you would go good, or do you think you would be bad?
That's a really good question. This might be one of the questions in the future, so I'm going to kind of answer this as well, because it ties into my answer of this. A lot of people have asked me what 2's other powers are, because all the other numbers have other powers, and for me, I really wanted it to be one of those things where 2 is just brutal, and so he doesn't have any powers outside of the pure telekinesis, but he is super powerful with that telekinesis. So it was like a master of that, but terrible at all the other stuff. So I feel like 2, no matter what, the only thing he would ever be good at is being like a mercenary type of character. So I think that at the end of the day, he's a soldier, and if it wasn't for Brenner, he would end up fighting for something because he wouldn't know what to do with himself. And really, it just depends on what person of power gets to him to decide if he's good or bad. If the right people get to him, he'll follow with his power the right path, the wrong people. I think he'd be easily manipulated.
Yeah, that is interesting. Milt Hansen had a really good question. She said, the masker scene at Hawkins was just crazy. What was it like for you to shoot something so graphic, and especially the fact that you had so many younger kids shooting such a graphic scene with their, you've seen them all posting their selfies online with like blood gooping down their eyes. Like they're like, hey.
It's like a mixture of things where because we got to spend a good amount of time on set, of course, we all develop these personal relationships with each other. And it's like we're real fake siblings. And so it is pretty disturbing in that sense. But everybody's joking around during that scene, largely because no one wants to stop long enough to think about just how disturbing and graphic it is. But like all the numbers were having fun with it. They were going into that big like visual effects. I don't know what it's called, but it takes like 700 different picture angles so that they can bring the kind of make little changes to your body. Everyone really enjoyed that. So because everybody was having fun with being part of something so effect heavy, it wasn't as like somber and depressing and dark as it might seem.
Did you have to do a lot of rehearsals for that or do any specialty work with the stunt team?
Not really, to be honest. I had like a brief semi like walkthrough whenever they put me on the wires when one was doing his thing to me on the wall. Other than that, not really. I also, though, because I was just in the corner, it was very rare that they even had me in the room when they were shooting. When I was off camera, they just kept me in my trailer or wrapped, though. I actually wasn't in the room for a huge amount of time.
Oh, that's interesting. Noctisa said that she's wondering, do you think Two could have possibly survived? Maybe he's just in a coma since you're almost as powerful as 11. And do you think Two survived or do you think he's a part of One now?
When I'm watching it, they shot it in a very ambiguous way. I'm the only number that you don't see any, like, close-ups or, like, any... They hid me behind that chair. I'll also say the Duffers are super-duper secretive, so I don't even know the answer to that question. It's possible. If that was their intention, they haven't revealed it to me either way.
I think it would be interesting in the finale because, you know, we've still got... Everyone is like, oh, well, Elle is the only number left, but she's not because we've still got Callie out there somewhere. And so I think it would be really cool because Callie has the ability to make people seeing things, and then you have, you know, your special ability. If you were alive, I think it would be really cool to have, like, I always like it when the villain ends up becoming the good guy. So I thought that was a really good question.
If they ask me back, I'm never gonna decline. I'll say that. But as of now, I don't even know.
Dorky Malevin says, I love your journal entries as Two. Was it easy to get into the character's mindset when portraying him, and did you base the character off anyone?
It's interesting. A lot of people ask me if I based the character off anyone, and I always say no, because the big breakthrough I had in my acting was actually finding a way to journal deeper into myself. And that's why I started doing the journal entries, is I started journaling just personally, and I started discovering all of these different things about myself that I didn't realize until I actually dug deep enough. And I was like, what if I did that with the characters that I'm doing? And so with Two, it actually was pretty easy for me to get into that headspace, because as dark and as brutal and as mean as he is, there's a part of him in me that all I had to do was figure out the right thoughts to put in my brain, the right way to manipulate my body to bring him out, and he's derived from some darker aspect of myself that I don't ever want to let out when I'm not acting, but it's still there. I was also in a very weird phase of my life when I booked that role, and actors have talked about in the past how it was just cosmic timing where they were just in the perfect part of their lives for the specific role that they read for at that time. And I was very much so. I was in a weird funk. I was in a weird place, and so there wasn't this huge journey I had to do to channel that. It was actually closer to the surface than it is now, or it probably will be. So,
how many days did you shoot? I know you were shooting in the Rainbow Room, which is a really kind of cool set, and when you guys were doing your 365 different camera angles, was that at Screen Gems in like a studio, or did you do everything in the Rainbow Room?
It wasn't Screen Gems. it was a different studio. I don't know specifically, but they had like this studio that basically had the rainbow room, and then you could enter the hallway where they shot like 11 running from Papa and that one thing where she has fire all behind her. And then they had the training room where we did the circle game. So we basically were just moving back and forth between those two sets, but it was in the same studio. I think we were filming for about 2 months. I wasn't filming every day, so I don't remember the specific amount of shoot days, but it was interesting because at the end of those 2 months, I flew back, and then they randomly flew me back out for, I think it was only like 2 or 3 days, just so that they could shoot that scene where I'm in the infirmary, okay, where I don't even say anything. I'm there lying in a bed. We fit and wrapped me in like 15 or 20 minutes.
When you were being directed by the Duffers, we didn't really get into that because we were talking about, what was his name, Nimrod?
Mm-hmm.
The director that you really admire and have a connection with. Did they do any kind of special direction for you? I'm just curious because, two, even though the story generally focuses on one and generally focuses on 11, I think a lot of people were so interested in two because it was just like, we weren't really given a lot of information about him. And you're like, well, he's the second. How did Brenner find him? How did Brenner decide that he wanted to do it again after that nightmare with one? And it was just very interesting. I'm wondering if the Duffers relayed anything to you whatsoever.
Yeah, so this is not me, like, intentionally trying to hide any, like, spoilers they gave me.
Yeah.
They didn't really. I think that my purpose was, of course, to set up one. But everybody has always been asking about, like, what all happened to the numbers and why it's only 11 and Kali that are still even, that have ever been mentioned. And so I don't feel like, and this is just me waxing poetic. I don't know what their overall intention is, but I never had the understanding that they were specifically trying to necessarily flesh out, like, where I came from. They were more so trying to show everybody where all of the numbers went and where they came from. So I don't think they were even thinking about, well, let's make sure 2 has this super intense backstory, because it wasn't as cool as my character is, as much as I loved him, as much as I loved kind of journaling deeper into him. I don't think I was, like, super important in the grand scheme of the mission that they had for the season. Maybe they might flesh something out more in the next season, but I felt like it was more so setting up one than anything else.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about how your character is, like, super intense. Are you an actor that comes to set and you're kind of like, I'm too? Or are you like, or do you, like, you just kind of live in your best life and then when it's time to go to set, you just kind of, like, turn it on?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, you have to enjoy it. If you're not enjoying it, what's the point? I would be miserable and I'd want to just destroy myself if I was staying in 2 for the entire time. No, so for me, it was one of those things where I, of course, always had my earbuds. There's a specific, like, 3 or 4 songs that they're these dark binaural beats that are at a specific frequency that can essentially manipulate the way that your emotions are kind of coming. It's more scientific than I probably have the terminology to talk about, but what I would essentially do is they would let me know a good estimate of how much time I had in between. And so I'd be nice, lovable Tristan. Hey, I'm just hanging out, make sure I can actually connect and build genuine relationships with people. And then as soon as I knew I was about to go on, shove those earbuds in. And then I would do this thing where I would just pace back and forth wherever I had the space and ability to do so. Because something about building that back and forth movement as opposed to just sitting down was allowing me to, one, start getting it into my body instead of keeping it intellectualized, and 2, start going ahead and building into that momentum that I knew I was going to have. So yeah, it was just a matter of plugging those headphones in, doing my pacing to start amping up my adrenaline and energy, probably like 10, 15 minutes before I knew I had to go on.
Was it a super emotional day when you and the other kids wrapped, when you guys were finished and you put a lot of intense work into stuff and you're filming during COVID and you're getting those red zone tests 3 times a day or whatever? It must have been a lot emotionally.
It was so sad because with me being one of the only numbers over 18, they always had to save my stuff for the very end. And so the kids would always be wrapped while I was still on set, like doing something. And so it was so sad because on the last day, all the kids were wrapped while I was filming my scene. And so I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to any of them, which that was sad. It's one of those things where, I mean, I was there for 2 months. My whole life, because I was in Atlanta on location, was the show. And it's just, it's crazy to leave all of that and go back to, it becomes the new normal and it's your everyday. And then to suddenly not have that, it's crazy. And it makes it hard to really know what to do with yourself when you come back. But
was it a little bit better when the show finally premiered and some of the episodes were coming out and, you know, the kids are getting on social media and they're all kind of reconnecting with everybody? It must have been like kind of a different sensation. Like, you're just so thrilled that you're seeing everything come to fruition. You're seeing your work. You're seeing your friends. Did that bring a little bit of joy?
A little bit, yeah. I will say that it was unfortunate, too, because all of the kid numbers, because most of them were in Atlanta, they had, like, a little premiere. But because I'm in Texas, I wasn't able to go. So they had a couple cool, like, get-togethers and celebrations I just wasn't able to go to. But it's also that thing where we filmed it a year and a half before it got released. So honestly, especially with me having a shaved head, by the time it came out, it felt like a fever dream. It didn't even feel real at that point. It almost felt nostalgic in a way watching back, which was so weird because I was thinking of all the memories that I had when I was seeing it as opposed to being engrossed in the show. And yeah, it was interesting.
Well, I'm sure you hear it all the time. I've seen you doing a lot of interviews and I'm like, how dare he dare talk to other people besides us? So rude. I think it was interesting because your character was so powerful. When you watched him, you felt bad. You feel bad for Eleven, but you feel bad in a completely different way. I think when he was bullying her, it was evident from the start. You could just tell, like, this is a person who has been bullied, and this is why he's doing it to Elle. I wish they would be friends. So what we do right now is we have a little section on the podcast that's just for fun, where we want people to be able to just feel like they can connect with you as a person. And we like to know generic things like, what's your favorite food?
I'm going to be basic, and I'm going to say I love salad so much.
No one will tell, Tristan. It's not basic.
I meant basic in this sense of, like, it's typical for, like, I don't know, people are like, oh, I love salad, and I'm, like, such a healthy, wonderful person because I eat salad. But I've more so had to manipulate myself into loving salad because my skin is so reactive to the point where I can have just, like, 2 grams of sugar, and it's going to flare me up. And so I have to be extremely and obnoxiously careful about what I eat. So salad has become, like, one of the only things that consistently won't break me out. Salmon is really good too.
If you were under Vecna's curse, you have to have been asked this, you have to know, what would your song be? What would you listen to?
Time by Hans Zimmer, or is it Hans? Hans Zimmer. It's from Inception, and it's one of those, like, movie soundtrack songs, but that has been with me through my entire life. I listen to it all the time, and it gets me into basically every mood. I can both cry and laugh and have this just wild joy while listening to it. So
if you're listening to music just in your free time, like if somebody's like, what kind of bands does Tristan listen to? Who are you into that's like contemporary?
Yes. So Jeremy Zucker, Chelsea Cutler, Aeyoni. I've been listening to CJ Starnes as well. And then I also like Jake Scott.
Cool. And then somebody wanted to know, do you have any favorite teen movies or teen actors?
Yes. I love Dylan O'Brien because I grew up watching Teen Wolf. I guess Florence Pugh is no longer a teen actor. Teen movie. Oh, there's this recent movie. I think it was called The Half of It. I thought that was really good. So dumb. Perk of Being a Wallflower is my favorite movie of all time. For the longest time, Emma Watson was probably my favorite teen actress because of Harry Potter and then Perks of Being a Wallflower. She's in her 30s or 40s now, so I guess she doesn't qualify, but that's my favorite movie of all time. I've never related to a main character more than I've related to Charlie. Like, he is so similar to, like, not, of course we have some differences, but In terms of my high school experience, it was very much so the experience of Charlie.
Yeah.
The only way to connect with anybody in life is authenticity, because as soon as you stop honoring that authenticity, even if you become friends with somebody, you'll never actually feel like they're a genuine friend if you're not authentic, all that kind of stuff. And people relate to what is real more than they would relate to what isn't. And so because of that, I've tried my best to become as much of an open book as I can and to be very vocal about the different emotional and personal struggles I go through, so that people don't think, oh, he's just this new teen actor that just auditioned, and then the very first thing he did, he got it, and now he's exploding, and that's all that. Like, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into every actor's career, and it's not always rainbows and sunshine. So the reason I said all that is because most of what I would share, I've already shared either online through my own personal social media or through another podcast, just because I try to share as much as I can. But my biggest mantra that I live life by, which I share because I actually established this on set of Stranger Things when I went through my identity crisis of wanting something for so long and then finally having it. And then once you have it, what do you do from there? How do you define yourself when you've defined yourself by wanting this thing? And my mantra is celebrate privately, love publicly. And what that means is that when I first did the show, I was so excited about it for very obvious reasons, and I wanted to share it with everybody. But because of how strict Netflix is with all of the NDAs and all that kind of stuff, it was a very long time before I got to share it. And talking about how it took so long for me to really post anything on social media, we weren't given the green light to post until the day that it dropped. So we weren't allowed to talk about it for basically the year and a half after we filmed it. And it got to a point where I realized the only reason I so badly want to share this is not because I genuinely just want to celebrate with people. It's because I need validation. Otherwise, this doesn't feel as big of a step. And so I realized, why am I defining so much of my success by how others are going to see me, or a post I may make online, or a resume that I may have? And so now I live my life by celebrating privately, which does not mean I never celebrate and I never post anything. It more so means I've changed my relationship to it, where my own validation, my own growth is the only thing I need for something to fulfill me. I don't need to bring other people into that to feel worthy and to feel enough. And so then love publicly just basically references that the only thing I can ever control in anybody is the way that I show up for them. I can't control whether they like me or they don't. I can't control if they open up to me or if they don't. There's so many things in interpersonal relationships we can never control. So the only thing I can control is, am I kind? Am I honest? Am I generous with my time? How can I show up for the people in my life to the best of my ability and trust that everything else I have no control over, so I don't need to even worry? And it's the same with like validation. Like, you can never control if somebody is gonna all that kind of stuff. So it's essentially just recognizing the only thing that I can focus on that matters, that is a good thing to shape my identity around, are the things that I can control. Otherwise, it's gonna be like I'm on shaky ground and I'm never gonna have any sustainable sense of self. And so yeah, that was a ramble.
No, you're a nice guy. It reminds me of this famous story of Mean Girls. Tina Fey was talking about casting them, and she's like, isn't it crazy when you cast someone to be, like, the meanest person, but they're actually the nicest person that you've ever talked to? And I feel like that's you. And I do think you should go to some cons if you get invited to, like, any stranger cons. Are you going to one?
San Diego International Comic-Con next week.
No way.
Oh, actually. And I'll be signing some autographs, so.
That's dope. Congratulations. I always talk to people, and they're like, I don't know if I'd want to do a con. And it's like, it's not for you. It's for the people. The people want to know. They want to see. That's super cool. Look, that's just your luck, isn't it? You get your first con, and it's like the biggest con.
I know. Well, and I'll tell you this. The funny thing is that, And this is what I, this is why I'm trying to get into the modality of just enjoy myself, just be present. I'm especially leaning on the celebrate privately, love publicly right now, because I found myself getting very nervous for the con, because I'm like, nobody cares if I'm going to be there. Like, there's nobody that, like, especially when I got, because I didn't like set this up. It was one of my friends that his dad was able to set it up for us, which I'm very thankful to James Gainier for setting everything up for us. But he set up like a little autograph station for me. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'll bring some stuff for people to sign. But the back of my head is like, everybody's going to look at me and be like, why are you here? Why are you trying? Of course, that's just our own opinion of ourselves that is trying to sabotage and prevent us from putting ourselves out there, which never does anything good. But it is interesting because I constantly feel that imposter syndrome. And I think it's important to share that, because I'm like, even people that may know who I am, that may listen to this, be like, oh, he's on this big show, I love this character, all that kind of stuff. They can think that, and I can still say, I feel like an imposter all the time. I feel like I don't deserve this all the time. And it's okay to feel like we're out of our element, as long as we take that self-grace and self-love to be like, well, even so, I'm just going to show up. I'm going to be here to the best of my ability, and then we'll see where that goes.
I think you should post that you're going to be at that Comic-Con, because I think you'll find that people will specifically go to that to see you. I know that there's been, my sister and I, when we started this podcast a while ago, like 6 years ago, we would go to any con that had any Stranger Things person. If they were in the show 3 seconds and we saw that they were going to be at a con, we were like packing up our car and we were driving there to meet the person. So you should post about it. You should share, because there will be people who will specifically go and like find you. And don't make it a self-fulfilling prophecy that no one wants to come see you. It's that they won't know where your booth is. You have to be like, I'm here, I'll be here, and then they will come to you, Tristan. They will find you. So
the only thing I'll say is that they're all sold out for this year's Comic-Con, so even if I posted and people want to come, I don't think they'd be able to get a badge at this point. But I might make a little post, be like, hey, y'all, I give it out. See, that's the thing, is I'm already planning. I'm going to look at, because I think, like, people charge for autographs or something like that at the booth.
Okay, yes, so they do. So when you go to your first cons, you don't know that. Like, when we went to our very first con, we had no idea, and we just went up to the table, because you pay so much money to get in, and then you go to the table, and the person's like, so I'll give you all this for whatever. Generally, people that are like, we'll say maybe in 80s movies, 90s movies, they're actors and you know them, but they haven't been acting for a while, they'll charge like $20 for an autograph. Okay. Like, I think we got Finn's autograph for $45. So, and Millie's are like $80. So it really just depends. But yeah, people do have to pay for them. But I think you should post it, because even though tickets are sold out, there's tons of people who have already purchased their passes that are Stranger Things fans. But once they know you're there, they'll make an effort to find where you are. And I honestly think if you don't share it, then the con will go by and then they'll be devastated that they didn't know you were there.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, why didn't he tell me? I would have found him.
Planning though is whenever I get to the autograph thing, I'm gonna take a look around, see what everyone's charging, and I'm gonna charge significantly less, so that people are like, oh, well, if we're gonna get one autograph, let's just get the cheapest autograph, and that I'll at least get some photos to give out, so I'm not left with just this big pile of stuff.
I feel like I want to call you and do an addendum to this episode after your con, just so you can be like, my table was flooded, they ran me over, I couldn't leave for hours.
Or I'll say, yeah, I now have all of these just random pictures of myself just hanging around in my suitcase.
You're awesome. You're a great person. I hope you have a lot of success. I mean, you're having the success. I really do want you to text me after you go to this con. I want to see. Text me a picture of yourself lonely at the booth. Oh.
Well, I'll have that face, and I'll look so humiliated.
I'll post it. We'll go live, and we'll be like, Tristan is at the con. Blood him. But yeah, thank you for your time. I always am really grateful when anyone from Stranger Things wants to talk to us.
For sure.
What are your main social media channels?
So I'll say this, because everybody was asking me, I actually did create a TikTok. I'm not super active. I post every blue moon, but there's like 3 TikToks on there. So it's just my name, Tristan Spone. I'm basic. I just have my first and last name for every social media on Instagram, YouTube. I can give a shout out as well. I can't talk about it, but I can at least tease that I've recently been attached to another show for a series regular part that will be filming later this year. I actually play a good guy in this one, so people can probably look out for maybe 2023 or something like that for another project coming out whenever.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you know
so there's stuff coming.
Awesome. Congratulations. Okay, well, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
You too. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Upside Down podcast hosted by Sisters Ash and Tori. For more information, visit our website at theupsidedownpod.com. You can also contact us at theupsidedownpod@gmail.com, as well as follow us on our Facebook and Instagram under The Upside Down Podcast. Episodes are released every other Monday, so be sure to subscribe. If you love the podcast, be sure to review us on whatever you listen to us on. Thanks again. Stay strange.